From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Friday marked the 54th anniversary of the announcement by then-President John F. Kennedy of a new relationship between the U.S. and its neighbors to the south.
139 years ago this week, the United States, stirred by the heroic struggle of its fellow Americans, urged the independence and recognition of the new Latin American republics. It was then, at the dawn of freedom throughout this hemisphere, that Bolivar spoke of his desire to see the Americas fashioned into the greatest region in the world. Greatest, he said, not so much by virtue of her area and her wealth, as by her freedom and her glory. Never in the long history of our hemisphere has this dream been nearer to fulfillment, and never has it been in greater danger. If we are to meet a problem so staggering in its dimension, our approach must itself be equally bold, an approach consistent with a majestic concept of Operation Pan America. Therefore, I have called on all people of the hemisphere to join in a new alliance for progress, Alianza Para Progresa, a vast cooperative effort unparalleled in magnitude and nobility of purpose to satisfy the basic needs of the American people for homes, work, and land, health, and schools, techo, trabajo, y tierra, salud y escuela.
The new relationship, however, was short-lived. Only a month later, on April 17, 1961, the Bay of Pigs invasion was launched. It resulted in a huge embarrassment for the new administration in front of the region and the world. More than a half century, and give or take a dozen or two revolutions and right-wing coups later, with a Contra war thrown in for good measure, the remarks made by a U.S. general Thursday had tongues wagging in a number of capitals in Latin America and the Caribbean about another possible U.S. coup, this one in Venezuela. Despite declarations to the contrary by President Barack Obama and the State Department, General John Kelly, head of the Southern Command, in charge of U.S. forces in Latin America and the Caribbean, spoke Thursday of a possible coup or other arrangements to depose Venezuela's elected socialist president, Nicolas Maduro. However, Kelly denied he was personally involved in any way in any coup preparations.
Could you address, kind of, first of all, what do you think of some of these accusations that have been launched against the United States recently, the apprehension of what they said was a U.S. pilot?
Right.
Also,
U.S. Air Force pilot, they actually said.
You know, what's your understanding of actually what's going on there? And then, you know, the country has experienced coups before. What do you think the risks are that it could degenerate into that kind of situation?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I'd say about Venezuela is, you know, it is really sad because they're sitting atop the largest oil reserves on the planet. They have nothing but fiscal potential. But over the years, due to a number of decisions made by the government, that has all atrophied to the point now where you have an unbelievable inflation rate of, you know, 65, 75, 80%. Anyone that lives there will tell you they don't, you know, you go into a store. Someone said to me that, in fact, a chargé of the country said, you know, now it's gotten to the point like in the old Soviet Union, if someone's walking down the street and sees a line, you get in the line because you don't know what's at the end of the line, but something must be at the end of the line. So you get in the line and it might be bread, it might be milk, or it might be toilet paper. That's kind of a critical item. Everyone talks about the complete lack of toilet paper in the country. So that's where the place is economically. You know, where the place is from a political point of view. I mean, obviously, he's clamped down pretty well on the newspapers, on the media. There's a fair number of people being arrested that are in the opposition. I mean, I think the opposition has gone from being in the political opposition to an enemy now. So real restrictions on them. Coup. You know, I don't know anyone that would want to take that mess over. But it might be that we see whether it's at the end of his term or whatever, I wouldn't necessarily a coup, but there might be, you know, with the same ruling party makes some arrangements to change leadership. But I certainly am not involved in any way, shape, or form with coup planning. I don't know anyone that is. And I probably would know if someone was.
Many observers were concerned over Monday's declaration by the White House that Venezuela constituted a threat to U.S. national security, with Glenn Ford of BlackAgendaReport.com saying it may be a prelude to a military attack.
President Obama, who is currently engaged in multiple wars on both the African and Asian continents, and is hell-bent on provoking a war in Europe with Russia, is now stepping to the very brink of war in South America against Venezuela. On Monday, Obama declared a state of national emergency to justify putting a freeze on the assets of seven Venezuelan officials that the U.S. claims are involved in human rights violations. In order to comply with U.S. law, Obama asserted that Venezuela represents a threat to the national security of the United States. The White House pretended that the scary language was just a legal technicality and does not mean that the president actually believes Venezuela is about to do harm to the United States. However, Obama is invoking the same language and law against Venezuela that was used against Syria and Iran, leading to Syria's near destruction by the U.S. and its allies and proxies, and to vicious sanctions and a state of near war with Iran. Venezuela has every reason to fear that Obama's executive order might be a prelude to military attack. Washington has been trying to topple the socialist government in Venezuela since at least 2002, when George Bush backed an unsuccessful coup against the late President Hugo Chavez. Since then, Venezuela has conducted more elections than any other nation in the hemisphere, all of them vouched for as free and fair by international observers. Unable to prevail at the polls, the right-wing racist opposition hopes to come to power through another coup or by direct military intervention by the United States. In that context, Obama's assertion that Venezuela is a danger to U.S. national security ranks just short of a declaration of war. Venezuelan President Maduro has thrown a few of the most brazen coup plotters in jail, which Obama ridiculously describes as a massive violation of human rights. However, the worst human rights violators in the hemisphere are Washington's allies. Almost 6 million people, most of them black and indigenous, have been displaced from their homes by political violence in Colombia, a U.S. client state. Mexico is a narco state as violent as Colombia, and Honduras, where the U.S. backed a military coup against the democratically elected government in 2009, is a place of lawlessness and state terror. Luckily, the United States has only a few remaining allies left in Latin America. What unifies the southern part of the hemisphere is the common experience of the U.S. boot on one's neck. CELAC, the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, which includes all of the nations of the Western Hemisphere except Canada and the U.S., has warned Washington to stop interfering in Venezuela's internal affairs. So, if Obama thinks that he can get away with waging a phony humanitarian interventionist war against Venezuelan President Maduro, as he did against Libya's Muammar Gaddafi, he will find himself opposed by an entire continent. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
The U.S. has renewed its call on Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to step down. State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki accused Damascus of brutality against the Syrian people. She praised the militants fighting Damascus and said it will not be possible to fully stabilize Syria as long as Assad is in power.
This week marks the fourth anniversary of the start of the Syrian revolution. On this somber occasion, we are reminded of all those who suffered and of the brave Syrians who stand up to tyranny and continue to struggle for a future of respect for basic rights, tolerance, and prosperity. We remember the aims of the peaceful protesters in March 2011 who called for the end of torture and demanded respect for human rights. Tens of thousands remain in Assad's prisons, where they are subjected to torture and inhumane conditions. For 4 years, the Assad regime has answered Syrians' calls for freedom and reform with unrelenting brutality, authoritarianism, and destruction. As we have long said, Assad must go and he be replaced through a negotiated political transition that is representative of the Syrian people. And as President Obama reiterated last month, it is not possible to fully stabilize Syria until Assad, who has lost legitimacy, is transitioned out. U.S. Special Envoy Rubenstein marked the fourth anniversary of the Syrian revolution with a video message released this morning in Arabic to the Syrian people, which is posted on Embassy Damascus's Facebook page. He emphasized that the Syrian people, not a dictator, foreign fighters, must determine their future, and that the United States stands with them. Tomorrow, Deputy Secretary Tony Blinken will address a reception at the State Department with Syrian diaspora and opposition leadership, including former SOC Presidents Muaz Hatib and Hadi al-Barra, as well as Interim Government Prime Minister Hassan Hito, ahead of the March 15th anniversary. U.S. officials will participate in several events with Syrian diaspora and opposition leadership to commemorate the start, the anniversary of 4 years ago.
President Assad won last year's presidential elections with 10,319,723 votes, being more than 88% of the ballots cast and more than 57% of the entire Syrian population, including children, of 17,952,000. The elections were monitored by observers from more than 30 countries, including Bolivia, Brazil, Cuba, Ecuador, India, Iran, Iraq, Nicaragua, Russia, South Africa, and Venezuela. They issued a joint statement saying the elections were free, fair, and transparent. Syria's permanent representative to the United Nations, Ambassador Bashar Ja'afari, said the international community has an obligation to put an end to the support for terrorists who are in his country killing Syrians with the backing of outside interests. He was speaking at the UN's conference on the common status of women Thursday.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. 4 years only were enough to form a point of departure in the life of Syrian women, 4 years during which numerous fires besieged Syrian women, the fire of extremism and terrorism, the fire of killing, slaughter, and kidnapping, the fire of collective rape, the fire of sexual slavery, the fires of sick Wahhabi ideology, the fire of forced marriage with foreign terrorists, and the fire of trafficking in people and other fires which undermined its role in society and stripped restrictions on it, on her, on women in their women and their dress and in their education, after the Syrian women had been a role model for their peers in the Arab and Islamic region over decades. Madam Chairperson, now, after long reluctance, the Secretary General of the United Nations, his representatives, and the Security Council, and the majority of member states present with us have acknowledged the truth of about terrorism in Syria. However, this admission was very belated and, unfortunately, at a price of thousands of Syrian lives, men, women, children, and the elderly, and the suffering of millions from the worst kinds of terrorism and the destruction of infrastructure and the displacement and of millions, not to speak of the suffering of the women and girls from the worst fatwas, mostly, especially the fatwa regarding sexual jihad, which still extends and whose effects are expanding day after day in the face of offensive international silence, even by those interested in rights of women, until it claimed victims among thousands of girls in Tunisia, Morocco, France, Britain, Austria, Germany, USA, Australia, and Canada. Despite this belated admission, some states which persist in their ignorance continue their former errors by following an erroneous approach in implementing UN Security Council resolution on eliminating terrorism based on politicization and double standards. As by way of example, a number of the representatives of member states in their statement expressed their outrage at the crimes perpetrated by ISIS and other groups in Syria and Iraq. The very same states ignore that the erroneous policies of their governments that continue towards my country were the main reason for the fact that the suffering of women in Syria have reached such a degree of deterioration because of the direct involvement of such government in financing terrorism, facilitating its access through borders and the armed armament of armed terrorist group and establishing training groups, training camps for terrorists before sending to Syria after rebranding them as moderate opposition. The United Nations, represented by UN Women, is called upon today to recognize the barbaric fatwas and the crimes permitted by the armed terrorist groups and to take serious actions to prevent the falling of women and innocent girls as victims of these shameful phenomena, since these ideas will undermine the rights of women all over the world. They are also called upon to provide support to the Syrian government in its aim to enable the women economically and socially and to build their own capacities to be more capable of actual participation in establishing social peace, in addition to activating their role in the reconstruction, which has become part of the government and civil bodies concerned in Syria. Finally, member states are called upon to support the struggle of the women in occupied Palestine and Syrian women in the occupied Golan against the occupation, which has violated their rights and prevented them from communicating with their motherland. They are also called upon to support the national options for Syrian women. They are capable of making their voices heard and effecting the change that they desire without any foreign intervention. Thank you, Madam Chairperson.
As the P5 plus one talks with Iran continue in Switzerland, a new open letter to Iran from the people of the United States, in contrast with the open letter from the 47 Republican senators, was making the rounds via social media. The letter can be seen at the website of the Answer Coalition at answercoalition.org. We spoke with Brian Becker of the Answer Coalition via Skype Friday. The letter from the American people to Iran is making its way around the world. I just looked at the website, and there's 70-some-odd pages of signatures already. You want to talk about this effort?
Yes, there's nearly 5,000 people have signed in the first 28 hours that the letter was circulated. Quite amazing, given the fact that we haven't done any advertising with the letter. It's really word of mouth or by email or social media, and people are getting it around. The letter obviously is a response to the letter of the 47 Republican senators lecturing the Iranian government about the ways that the U.S. Constitution works, all, of course, with the intention of sabotaging any possible negotiated settlement before there is a settlement between the United States and Iran over the nuclear question. Our letter tracks their letter in terms of form, and you can see if you put the two letters next to each other how it does just that. But what our letter says is that we're telling the Iranian people and the leaders of the Islamic Republic of Iran that we, the people of the United States, are aware that the U.S. government is a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT, and that treaty, as all approved treaties, and treaties are approved by a two-thirds majority in the Senate and then signed into law, they become, according to the Constitution, the supreme law of the land. And the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty puts an affirmative obligation on all nuclear powers, and of course the United States being the biggest, to begin the disarmament of its own nuclear stockpile and to enter into good faith negotiations with other countries for the purpose of carrying out a complete, thorough, and 100% nuclear disarmament under strict, effective international control. And that contrary to its affirmative obligation to do this, the United States government possesses thousands of nuclear weapons, about 5,000 of which are operational. It's improving, not discarding these weapons. It's improving the platforms for their delivery on new fighter aircraft carriers, which cost the American people $2 billion per plane, on land missile systems, on aircraft carriers, and on nuclear submarines. And at the same time, the United States government, in violation of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, gives $4 billion every year to the State of Israel, which, unlike Iran, refuses to sign the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, refuses to open its country for International Atomic Agency, Energy Agency employees to inspect it, because Israel, in fact, has a large nuclear arsenal. So the United States, by giving $4 billion a year to Israel — Israel is the largest recipient of U.S. Military aid — is contributing to the lawless breaking of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty by one of Iran's neighbors, in this case, the State of Israel. And so our letter informs the Iranian government from the American people that we are aware that the government of this country is in violation of the supreme law of the land, as the Constitution states treaties are, and that we recognize, too, that the letter by the 47 senators, which is designed to sabotage any nuclear arrangement or a peaceful settlement of the U.S.-Iranian conflict, is designed not to bring peace, but really to bring more war. And there's nothing that the United States population opposes more than another war in the Middle East and a war against Iran. So our letter states those things. And as we can see, Don, the number of signers has just blossomed in the last day since this letter went out. And as I said, we have almost 5,000 people. We hope to have tens of thousands of signers, because we believe that sends a powerful message, not only to the people in Iran and to the people in the Middle East, but to the people in the United States who are, in fact, enraged that the Republicans in the Senate, working hand in glove with the Israeli government, are doing everything to sabotage a nuclear settlement with Iran, not because they fear that Iran poses an existential nuclear threat to Israel — again, Israel has 200 nuclear weapons or about — but because the Israeli government and these right-wing hawks in America fear the outbreak of peace in the Middle East, whereby there will be a lessening of tension between the United States and Iran. And that would, of course, diminish Israel's centrality to as an extension of American power in this region. So that's the real deal. That's the real backstory behind that senator's letter.
And just very briefly, a poll came out today from Israel. Apparently Netanyahu's party is poised to lose the elections. Are you afraid of some sort of October surprise coming out of Netanyahu's pocket in the form of an attack on Iran?
I doubt it, because Israel would pay a very heavy price if they were to attack Iran. Iran is not a minor power. Iran has 80 million people. It has a large military. It has missiles that have certainly the capability of hitting Israel. The United States would go, I think, completely bonkers over any Israeli strike against Iran at the moment that the U.S. government is poised to possibly have a negotiated settlement with Iran. And I'd like to say, if I could, that, you know, the original October surprise, for your listeners who are younger than us, and may not know, it was clear that Ronald Reagan and the Republican, the extreme right wing of the Republican Party, worked out a deal with the leadership of the Islamic Republic of Iran, who at that time held hostages from the American embassy, which they had declared — the students in Iran had declared — to be a spy center, which of course it was, and a center of torture. But, you know, Carter lost the election in 1980 largely because of his inability to resolve the hostage crisis. And the Iranians were just steadfast. They wouldn't release the hostages. But the very first day Ronald Reagan took office, on January 20th, 1981, was the day that the hostages were released by Iran. And so it was clear that there had been a back deal between the Republican Party and the Islamic Republic leadership to not release the hostages with the purpose of undoing the Carter administration's reelection bid. And of course, the Iranians were against Carter because, one, Carter brought the Shah, the hated Shah, to America for medical treatment and political asylum rather than allowing him to stand for justice in Iran for all of his crimes. And secondly, the Carter administration encouraged the Iraqi government to invade Iran in early part of 1980 as a way to weaken the Islamic Republic. So, but you saw here the Republican Party, which says now that Iran poses an existential threat to everyone, Israel, America. Clearly, that their icon, Ronald Reagan, was making backroom deals with the Islamic Republic even before he took office in 1981, and then again, of course, during the 1985-86 Iran-Contra scandal.
So much for the argument that it's an irrational regime that can't be rationally dealt with.
Exactly. The United States has conflicted with Iran, partnered with Iran. Its historic reason that it hasn't had relations with Iran since 1979 is that it's hoping that, or was hoping, and I think the United States government, or at least the Obama team, no longer believes that the Islamic Republic can be overturned through regime change. What they've wanted all these years was to go back to the good old days when they had a U.S.-installed monarch who functioned as a proxy, as a puppet, and the U.S. was completely happy with the Shah, who they installed through a CIA coup in 1953 after Mossack Day, the democratically elected government, nationalized the Anglo-Iranian oil company, now known as British Petroleum, BP. So the U.S. Was really opposed to the Islamic Republic because they always hoped it could be overthrown. But the truth is, if it can't be overthrown, some section of the U.S. capitalist imperial ruling class feels maybe it's better to have a rapprochement with Iran, which Iran or at least some sectors of their establishment clearly want, for the purposes of partnering with them rather than fighting them in a situation where the U.S. has lost a great amount of influence already in the Middle East because of the Iraq War.
And you mentioned rightly the role of oil in that. After Mossadegh had nationalized the British oil holdings in Iran, and after he was deposed by a U.S. coup, the Shah made a deal and surrendered much of the oil to U.S. oil companies and the British.
Right. What they did is after the CIA the U.S. imposed sanctions on Mossadegh, they used the same colorful, demonizing language against him that they used against the Islamic Republic. That they never used against the Shah. They demonized him. Parts of the population went into unhappiness because of economic destabilization. They overthrew him in a coup. The Shah came in, denationalized the oil, but because the CIA did the dirty work, 60% of the British Petroleum holdings stayed with British Petroleum. 40% went to Gulf Oil. Kermit Roosevelt, who led the coup, was rewarded by becoming vice chairman of Gulf Oil in 1956. So it was a very tidy affair.
Okay, Brian Becker, Answer Coalition. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Speculation in U.S. media that President Putin is missing is apparently unfounded, as are rumors making it around Europe that he's just had a baby. According to an article in TASS, President Vladimir Putin's spokesperson Dmitry Peskov Friday dismissed rumors that a baby had been born through the Russian president. Peskov said to Forbes magazine, commenting on some European reports, quote, "The information of a baby born to Vladimir Putin is false. I'm going to ask people who have money to organize a contest for the best media rumor," closed quote. Putin has two daughters, Maria and Katerina, who were born in 1985 and 1986. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.